she collected those bits off the floor, like wood shavings, and she made them into fuel, into fire, and burned, bright enough to see forever. This was troubling, but it was, after all, just a poem. Scrolling through some emails, she'd found one to Charlotte, a Cayley band flautist with earthy humour, who'd been Nora's only friend at String Theory before she had moved back up to Scotland. "Hi, Charl. Hope all is fine and dandy. Pleased the birthday do went well. Sorry I couldn't be there. All is well in sunny Sydney. I finally moved into the new place. It's right near Bronte Beach. Beautiful. Lots of neighbourhood cafes and charm. I also have a new job. I go swimming in a saltwater pool every morning, and every evening I drink a glass of Australian wine in the sunshine. Life is good. Address: 229 Darling Street, Bronte, New South Wales, 2024, Australia. Nora, kiss." Something was rotten. The tone of vague, distant perkiness, as if writing to a long-lost aunt. The lots of neighbourhood cafes and charm, as though it was a TripAdvisor review. She didn't speak to Charlotte, or indeed anyone, like that. There was also no mention of Izzy. Have finally moved into the new place. Was that we have, or I have? Charlotte knew of Izzy. Why not mention her? She would soon find out. Indeed, 20 minutes later, she was standing in the hallway of her apartment, staring at four bags of rubbish that needed taking out. The living room looked small and depressing, the sofa tatty and old. The place smelt slightly mouldy. There was a poster on the wall for the video game Angel, and a vape pen on a coffee table with a marijuana leaf sticker on it. A woman was staring at a screen shooting zombies in the head. The woman had short blue hair, and for a moment Nora thought it might be Izzy. "Hi," Nora said. The woman turned. She was not Izzy. She had sleepy eyes and a vacant expression, as if the zombies she was shooting had slightly infected her. She was probably a perfectly decent person, but she was not anyone Nora had ever seen in her life. She smiled. "Hey. How's that new poem coming along?" "Oh, yeah, it's coming along really well, thanks." Nora walked around the flat in a bit of a daze. She opened a door at random and realized it was the bathroom. She didn't need the toilet, but she needed a second to think. So she shut the door and washed her hands and stared at the water spiral down the plug hole the wrong way. She glanced at the shower. The dull yellow curtain was dirty in a vague student house kind of way. That's what this place reminded her of. A student house. She was 35 and, in this life, living like a student. She saw some antidepressants, fluoxetine, beside the basin and picked up the box. She read "Prescription for N-Seed" at the top of the label. She looked down at her arm and saw the scars again. It was weird to have your own body offer clues to a mystery. There was a magazine on the floor next to the bin, National Geographic, the one with a black hole on its cover that she had been reading in another life on the other side of the world only yesterday. She sensed it was her magazine, given she'd always liked reading it and had been known, even in recent times, to buy it on the occasional spontaneous whim, as no online version ever did the photos justice. She remembered being 11 years old and looking at the photos of Svalbard, the Norwegian archipelago in the Arctic, in her dad's copy. It had looked so vast and desolate and powerful, and she had wondered what it would have been like to be among it, like the scientist explorers in the article, spending their summer doing some kind of geological research. She cut out the pictures and they ended up on the pinboard in her bedroom. And for many years at school, she had tried hard at science and geography just so she could be like the scientists in the article and spent her summers among frozen mountains and fjords as puffins flew overhead. But after her dad died, and after reading Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil, she decided that A, philosophy seemed to be the only subject that matched her sudden inward intensity, and B, she wanted to be a rock star more than a scientist anyway. After leaving the bathroom, she returned to her mysterious flatmate. She sat on the sofa and waited for a few moments, watching. The woman's avatar got shot in the head. "Piss off, you zombie fuckface!" The woman snarled happily at the screen. She picked up the vape pen. Nora wondered how she knew this woman. She was assuming they were flatmates.
"I've been thinking about what you said."
"What did I say?" Nora asked.
"About doing some cat sitting, you know. You wanted to look after that cat."
"Oh, yeah, sure, I remember."
"Bad fucking idea, man."
"Really?
Cats.
What about them?"
"They've got a parasite. Toxoplasma something."
Nora knew this. She had known this since she was a teen, doing her work experience at Bedford Animal Rescue Center.
Toxoplasmosis.
"That's it? Well, I was listening to this podcast, right? And there's this theory that this international group of billionaires infected the cats with it so they could take over the world by making humans dumber and dumber. I mean, think about it. There are cats everywhere. I was talking to Jared about this and Jared said, 'Jojo, what are you smoking?' And I was like, 'The stuff you gave me.' And he said, 'Yeah, I know.' And he told me about the grasshoppers."
"Grasshoppers?"
"Yeah. Did you hear about grasshoppers?" Jojo asked.
"What about them?"
"They're all killing themselves because this parasitic worm grows inside them to become like a full-grown aquatic creature. And as it grows, it takes over the brain function of the grasshopper. So the grasshopper thinks, 'Hey, I really like water.' And so they dive bomb into water and die. And it's happening all the time. Google it. Google grasshopper suicide. Anyway, the point is, the elites are killing us via cats, and so you shouldn't be near them."
Nora couldn't help thinking how different this life was to her imagined version of it. She had pictured herself and Izzy on a boat near Byron Bay, marveling at the magnificence of humpback whales. And yet she was here in a small pot-scented apartment in Sydney with a conspiracy theorist as a flatmate who wouldn't even let her near a cat.
"What happened to Izzy?"
Nora realized she just asked the question out loud. Jojo looked confused.
"Izzy?
Your old friend, Izzy?"
"Yeah.
The one who died?" The words came so fast Nora could hardly absorb them.
What?
The car crash girl?"
"What?"
Jojo looked confused as curls of smoke wisped across her face.
"You okay, Nora?"
She held out the joint.
"Want a toke?"
"No, I'm okay, thanks." Jojo chuckled. "Makes a change." Nora grabbed her phone, went online, typed Isabel Hirsch into the search box, then clicked news. There it was. A headline. Above a picture of Izzy's tanned face, smiling. British woman killed in New South Wales road collision. A woman, 33, was killed and three people hospitalised south of Coffs Harbour last night when the woman's Toyota Corolla collided with a car travelling in the opposite direction on the Pacific Highway. The female driver, identified as British citizen Isabel Hirsch, died at the scene of the accident just before 9 p.m. She was the only person in the Toyota. According to her flatmate, Nora Seed, Isabel had been driving from Brisbane back to Byron Bay to attend Nora's birthday party. Isabel had recently started working for Byron Bay whale watching tours. "I am totally devastated," Nora said. "We travelled to Australia together only a month ago, and Izzy had planned to stay here for as long as possible. She was such a force of life that it feels impossible to imagine the world without her in it. She was so excited about her new job, It's so unbearably sad and hard to comprehend. The passengers of the other car all suffered injuries, and the driver, Chris Dale, had to be airlifted to the hospital at Baringo. New South Wales police are asking anyone who witnessed the collision to come forward to help with their inquiries.
"Oh my God," she whispered to herself, feeling faint. "Oh, Izzy."
She knew that Izzy wasn't dead in all her lives, or even most of them. But in this one it was real, and the grief Nora felt real too. The grief was familiar and terrifying and laced with guilt. Before she could properly process anything, the mobile rang. It said, "Work." A man's voice, a slow drawl. "Where are you?"
"What?"
"You were meant to be here half an hour ago."
"Where?"
"The ferry terminal. You're selling tickets. I've got the correct number, right? This is Nora Seed I'm talking to."
"It's one of them," sighed Nora, as she gently faded away.
Fish tank. The shrewd-eyed librarian was back at her chessboard and hardly looked up as Nora arrived back.
"Well, that was terrible."
Mrs. Elm smiled wryly.
"It just shows you, doesn't it?"
"Shows me what?"
"Well, that you can choose choices, but not outcomes.
But I stand by what I said. It was a good choice. It just wasn't a desired outcome."
Nora studied Mrs. Elm's face. Was she enjoying this?
"Why did I stay?"
Nora asked.
"Why didn't I just come home after she died?"
Mrs. Elm shrugged.
"You got stuck. You were grieving. You were depressed. You know what depression is like."
Nora understood this. She thought of a study she had read about somewhere, about fish. Fish were more like humans than most people think. Fish get depression. They had done tests with zebrafish. They had a fish tank, and they drew a horizontal line on the side of it, halfway down in marker pen. Depressed fish stayed below the line. But give those same fish Prozac, and they go above the line, to the top of their tanks, darting about like new. Fish get depressed when they have a lack of stimulation, a lack of everything, when they are just there, floating in a tank that resembles nothing at all. Maybe Australia had been her empty fish tank, once Izzy had gone. Maybe she just had no incentive to swim above the line. And maybe even Prozac, or fluoxetine, wasn't enough to help her rise up. So she was just going to stay there in that flat, with Jojo, and never move until she was made to leave the country. Maybe even suicide would have been too active. Maybe in some lives you just float around and expect nothing else and don't even try to change. Maybe that was most lives.
"Yes," said Nora, aloud now. "Maybe I got stuck. Maybe in every life I'm stuck. I mean, maybe that's just who I am. A starfish in every life is still a starfish. There isn't a life where a starfish is a professor of aerospace engineering. And maybe there isn't a life where I'm not stuck."
"Well, I think you're wrong." "Okay then, I would like to try the life where I am not stuck. What life would that be?"
"Aren't you supposed to tell me?"
Mrs. L moved a queen to take a pawn, then turned the board around.
"I'm afraid I'm just the librarian."
"Librarians have knowledge. They guide you to the right books, the right worlds. They find the best places, like soul-enhanced search engines."
"Exactly. But you also have to know what you like. What to type into the metaphorical search box.
and sometimes you have to try a few things before that becomes clear. I haven't got the stamina. I don't think I can do this. The only way to learn is to live.
Yes, so you keep saying.
Nora exhaled heavily. It was interesting to know that she could exhale in the library, that she felt entirely in her body, but it felt normal. Because this place was definitely not normal, and the real physical her wasn't here. It couldn't be. And yet it was, to all intents and purposes, because she was, in some sense, there, standing on a floor, as if gravity still existed.
Okay, she said.
I would like a life where I am successful. Mrs. Elm tuttered disapprovingly.
For someone who has read a lot of books, you aren't very specific with your choice of words.
Sorry.
Success. What does that mean to you? Money?
No.
Well, maybe. But that wouldn't be the defining feature.
Well then, what is success?
Nora had no idea what success was. She had felt like a failure for so long.
Mrs. Elm smiled patiently.
Would you like to consult again with the Book of Regrets?
Would you like to think about those bad decisions that turned you away from whatever you feel success is?
Nora shook her head quickly, like a dog shaking off water. She didn't want to be confronted with that long, interminable list of mistakes and wrong turns again. She was depressed enough. And besides, she knew her regrets. Regrets don't leave. They weren't mosquito bites. They itch forever.
No, they don't, said Mrs. Elm, reading her mind.
You don't regret how you were with your cat, and nor do you regret not going to Australia with Izzy.
Nora nodded. Mrs. Elm had a point. She thought of swimming in the pool at Bronte Beach. How good that had felt in its strange familiarity.
From an early age, you were encouraged to swim, said Mrs. Elm.
Yes.
Your dad was always happy to take you to the pool.
It was one of the few things that had made him happy, Nora mused. She had associated swimming with her father's approval and enjoyed the wordlessness of being in the water because it was the opposite of her parents screaming at each other.
Why did you quit? Asked Mrs. Elm.
As soon as I started winning swimming races, I became seen. And I didn't want to be seen.
And not only seen, but seen in a swimsuit at the exact age you were self-obsessing about your body.
Someone said I had boy's shoulders. It was a stupid thing, but there were lots of stupid things, and you feel them all at that age. As a teenager, I'd have happily been invisible. People called me the fish. They didn't mean it as a compliment. I was shy. It was one of the reasons I preferred the library to the playing field. It seems a small thing, but it really helped having that space.
Never underestimate the big importance of small things, Mrs. Elm said.
You must always remember that.
Nora thought back. Her teenage combination of shyness and visibility had been a problematic mix, but she was never bullied, as such, probably because everyone knew her brother. And Joe, while never exactly tough, was always considered cool and popular enough for his most immediate blood relation to be immune from schoolyard tyranny. She won races in local and then national competitions, but as she reached 15, it became too much. The daily swims, length after length after length.
I had to quit.
Mrs. Elm nodded, and the bond you developed with your dad frayed and almost snapped completely.
Pretty much.
She pictured her father's face in the car on a drizzle-scratch Sunday morning outside Bedford Leisure Centre, as she told him she didn't want to swim in competitions anymore. That look of disappointment and profound frustration.
But you could make a success of your life, he had said.
Yes, She remembered it now.
You're never going to be a pop star, but this is something real. It's right in front of you. If you keep training, you'll end up at the Olympics. I know it.
She had been cross with him for saying that. As if there was a very thin path to a happy life, and it was the path he had decided for her. As if her own agency and her own life was automatically wrong. But what she didn't fully appreciate at 15 years of age was just how bad regret could feel, and how much her father had felt that pain of being so near to the realization of a dream he could almost touch it. Nora's father, it was true, had been a difficult man. As well as being highly critical of everything Nora did, and everything Nora wanted and everything Nora believed, unless it was related to swimming, Nora had also felt that simply to be in his presence was to commit some kind of invisible crime. Ever since the ligament injury that thwarted his rugby career, he'd had a sincere conviction that the universe was against him. And Nora was, at least she felt, considered by him as part of that same universal plan. From that moment in the car park, she had felt she was really just an extension of the pain in his left knee. A walking wound. But maybe he had known what would happen. Maybe he could foresee the way one regret would lead to another. Until suddenly that was all she was. A whole book of regrets. Okay, Mrs. Elm. I want to know what happened in the life where I did what my father wanted. Where I trained as hard as I possibly could. Where I never moaned about a 5 a.m. start or a 9 p.m. finish. Where I swam every day and never thought about quitting. Where I didn't get sidelined by music or writing unfinished novels. Where I sacrificed everything else on the altar of freestyle. Where I didn't give up. Where I did everything right in order to reach the Olympics. Take me to where I am in that life. For a moment it seems as though Mrs. Elm hadn't been taking any notice of Nora's mini-speech, as she kept frowning at the chessboard, working out how to outmaneuver herself. The rook is my favourite piece, she said. It's the one that you don't think you have to watch out for. It is straightforward. You keep your eye on the queen and the knights and the bishop, because they are the sneaky ones. But it's the rook that often gets you. The straightforward is never quite what it seems. Nora realized Mrs. Elm was probably not talking just about chess. But the shelves were moving now, fast as trains. This life you've asked for, explained Mrs. Elm, is a little bit further away from the pub dream and the Australian adventure. Those were closer lives. This one involves a lot of different choices, going back further in time, and so the book is a little further away. You see? I see. Libraries have to have a system. The book slowed. Ah, here we are. This time Mrs. Elm didn't stand up. She simply raised her left hand and a book flew towards her. How did you do that? I have no idea. Now here's the life you asked for. Off you go. Nora took hold of the book. Light, fresh, lime-coloured. She turned to the first page. And this time she was aware of feeling absolutely nothing at all. The last update that Nora had posted before she found herself between life and death. I miss my cat. I'm tired. The successful life. She had been asleep, a deep, dreamless nothing. And now, thanks to the ring of a phone alarm, she was awake and didn't know where she was. The phone told her it was 6:30 a.m. A light switch beside the bed appeared, thanks to the glow of the screen. Switching it on, she could see she was in a hotel room. It was rather plush. In a bland and blue and corporate kind of way. A tasteful, semi-abstract sub-Cézanne painting of an apple, or maybe a pear, was framed on the wall. There was a half-empty cylinder-shaped glass bottle of still mineral water beside the bed, and an unopened collection of shortbread biscuits. Some printed-out papers, too, stapled together. A timetable of some sort. She looked at it. Itinerary for Nora Seed, OBE, guest speaker. Gulliver Research Inspiring Success, Spring Conference. 8:45 a.m. Meet Priya Navaluri, Gulliver Research, and Rory Longford, celebrity speakers, and Jay in lobby, Intercontinental Hotel. 9 a.m. Soundcheck. 9:05 a.m. Tech run-through. 9:30 a.m. Nora to wait in VIP area or watch first speaker in main hall. J.P. Blythe, inventor of Me Time app and author of Your Life, Your Terms. 10:15 a.m. Nora to deliver talk. 10:45 a.m. Audience Q&A. 11 a.m. Meet and greet. 11:30 a.m. Finish. Nora Seed, OBE. Inspiring success. So there was a life in which she was a success. Well, that was something. She wondered who Jay was and the other people she was supposed to meet in the lobby. And then she put the sheet of paper down and got out of bed. She had a lot of time. Why was she getting up at 6:30 a.m.? Maybe she swam every morning. That would make sense. She pressed a button and the curtain slid open with a low whir to reveal a view of water and skyscrapers in the white dome of the O2 arena. She had never seen this precise view from this precise angle before. London, Canary Wharf, about 20 stories up. She went to the bathroom, beige tiles, large shower cubicle, fluffy white towels, and realized she didn't feel as bad as she usually did in the morning. There was a mirror filling half the opposing wall. She gasped at her appearance, and then she laughed. She looked so ridiculously healthy and strong, and in this life had terrible taste in nightwear. Pajamas, mustard green, plaid. The bathroom was quite large, large enough to get down on and do some push-ups. 10 full ones in a row, no knees, without even getting out of breath. Then she held a plank and tried it with one hand, then the other hand, with hardly a tremor. Then she did some burpees, no problem at all. Wow. She stood up and patted her rock-hard stomach, remembered how wheezy she had been in her root life, walking up the high street, technically only yesterday. She hadn't felt this fit since she was a teenager. In fact, this might be the fittest she had ever felt. Stronger, certainly. Searching Facebook for Isabel Hirsch, she found out that her former best friend was alive and still living in Australia, and this made Nora happy. She didn't even care that they weren't social media friends, as it was highly probable that in this life Nora hadn't gone to Bristol University. And even if she had, she wouldn't have been doing the same course. It was a bit humbling to realize that, even though this Isabel Hirsch might never have met Nora Seed, she was still doing the same things she was doing in Nora's root life. She also checked in on Dan. He was, seemingly, happily married to a spin class instructor called Gina. Gina Lord, nay Sharp. It had a wedding in Sicily. Nora then googled Nora Seed. Her Wikipedia page, she had a Wikipedia page, informed her that she had indeed made it to the Olympics. Twice. And that she specialized in freestyle. She had won a gold medal for 800 meters freestyle with a ridiculous time of 8 minutes and 5 seconds and had a silver for 400 meters. This had been when she was 22 years old. She had won another silver medal when she was 26 for her participation in a 4x100-meter relay. It got even more ridiculous when she read that she had briefly been the world record holder for women's 400-meter freestyle at the World Aquatic Championships.
She had then retired from international competition. She had retired at 28. She apparently now worked for the BBC during their coverage of swimming events, had appeared on the TV show A Question of Sport, had written an autobiography called Sink or Swim, was an occasional assistant coach at British Swimming GB, and still swam for 2 hours every day. She gave a lot of money to charitable causes, namely to Marie Curie Cancer Care, and she had organised a fundraising charity swimathon around Brighton Pier for the Marine Conservation Society. Since retiring from professional sport, she had swum the Channel twice. There was a link to a TED talk she had given about the value of stamina in sport, and training, and life. It had over 1 million views. As she began to watch it, Nora felt as though she was watching someone else. This woman was confident, commanded the stage, had great posture, smiled naturally as she spoke, and managed to make the crowd smile and laugh and clap and nod their heads at all the right moments. She had never imagined she could be like this, and tried to memorize what this other Nora was doing, but realized there was no way she would be able to. People with stamina aren't made any differently to anyone else, she was saying. The only difference is they have a clear goal in mind and a determination to get there. Stamina is essential to stay focused in a life filled with distraction. It is the ability to stick to a task when your body and mind are at their limit. The ability to keep your head down, swimming in your lane, without looking around worrying who might overtake you. Who the hell was this person? She skipped a little further into the video, and this other Nora was still talking with the confidence of a self-help Joan of Arc. If you aim to be something you are not, you will always fail. Aim to be you. Aim to look and act and think like you. Aim to be the truest version of you. Embrace that you-ness. Endorse it. Love it. Work hard at it. And don't give a second thought when people mock it or ridicule it. Most gossip is envy in disguise. Keep your head down. Keep your stamina. Keep swimming. Keep swimming, Nora mumbled, echoing this other self and wondering if the hotel had a pool. The video disappeared, and a second later her phone started to buzz. A name appeared, Nadia. She didn't know any Nadias in her original life. She had no idea if seeing the name would have inspired this version of her with happy anticipation or sinking dread. There was only one way to find out. Hello? Svitat, came a voice she didn't recognize. A voice that was close, but not entirely warm. She had an accent, maybe Russian. I hope you're okay. Hi, Nadia. Thanks, I'm fine. I'm just here in the hotel, getting ready for a conference. She tried to sound jolly. Oh yeah, the conference. £15,000 for a talk. Sounds good. It sounded ridiculous. But she also wondered how Nadia, whoever Nadia was, knew this. Oh, yeah. Joe told us. Joe? Yeah. Well, listen, I need to talk to you at some point about your father's birthday. What? I know he'd love it if he could come up and see us. Her whole body went cold and weak, as if she had seen a ghost. She remembered her father's funeral. Hugging her brother as they cried on each other's shoulders. My dad. My dad. My dead dad. He's just come in from the garden. Do you want a word with him? This was so remarkable. So world-shattering, it was totally out of sync with her tone of voice. She said it casually, almost as if it was nothing at all. What? Do you want a word with Dad? It took her a moment. She felt suddenly off balance. She could hardly speak or breathe. She didn't know what to say. Everything felt unreal. It was like time travel, as though she had fallen through two decades. It was too late to respond because the next thing she heard was Nadia saying, "Here he is." Nora nearly hung up the phone. Maybe she should have, but she didn't. Now she knew it was a possibility she needed to hear his voice again. His breath first, then, "Hi Nora, how are you?" Just that. Casual, non-specific, every day. It was him, his voice, his strong voice that had always been so clipped. But a little thinner, maybe. A little weaker. A voice 15 years older than it was meant to be. "Dad," she said. Her voice was a stunned whisper. "It's you." "You all right, Nora? Is this a bad line? Do you want to FaceTime?" FaceTime. To see his face. No. That would be too much. This was already too much. Just the idea that there was a version of her dad alive at a time after FaceTime was invented. Her dad belonged in a world of landlines. When he died, he was only just warming to radical concepts like emails and text messages. "No," she said. "It was me. I was just thinking of something. I'm a bit distant. Sorry. How are you?" "Fine. We took Sally to the vets yesterday." She assumed Sally was a dog. Her parents had never had a dog or any pet. Nora had begged for a dog or a cat when she was little, but her dad always said they tied you down. "What was wrong with her?" Nora asked, trying to sound natural again. "Just her ears again. That infection keeps coming back." "Oh, right," she said, as though she knew Sally and her problematic ears. "Poor Sally. I love you, Dad. And I just want to say that..." "Are you all right, Nora? You're sounding a bit emotional." "I just don't tell you that enough. I just want you to know I love you. You are a good father. And in another life, the life where I quit swimming, I am full of regret over that." "Nora?" She felt awkward asking him anything, but she had to know. The question started to burst out of her like water from a geyser. "Are you okay, Dad?"
"Why wouldn't I be?"
"Just, you know, you used to worry about chest pains."
"Haven't had them since I got healthy again. That was years ago. You remember my health kick? Hanging around Olympians does that to you. Got me back to rugby fit. Put me up to 16 years off the drink, too. Cholesterol and blood pressure low, the doc says."
"Yes, of course. I remember the health kick." And then another question came to her, but she had no idea how to ask it. So she did it directly. "How long have you been with Nadia now again?"
"Are you having memory problems or something?"
"No. Well, yes, maybe. I've just been thinking a lot about life recently."
"Are you a philosopher now?"
"Well, I studied it."
"When?"
"Never mind. I just can't remember how you and Nadia met." She heard an awkward sigh down the phone. He sounded terse.
"You know how we met. Why are you bringing all this up? Is this something that therapist is opening up? Because you know my feelings on that."
"I have a therapist." "Sorry, Dad."
"That's all right.
I just want to know that you're happy."
"Of course I am. I've got an Olympic champion for a daughter and have finally found the love of my life."
"And you're getting back on your feet again?"
"Mentally, I mean. After Portugal."
Nora wanted to know what had happened in Portugal, but she had another question to ask first.
What about Mum?
Wasn't she the love of your life?
Once upon a time she was. But things change. Nora, come on, you're a grown-up.
Nora put her dad on speaker, clicked back to her own Wikipedia page. Sure enough, her parents had divorced after her father had an affair with Nadia Vanko, mother of a Ukrainian male swimmer, Yegor Vanko. And in this timeline, her mother had died way back in 2011. And all this because Nora had never sat in that car park in Bedford and told her dad she didn't want to be a competitive swimmer. She felt that feeling again, like she was fading away, that she had worked out that this life wasn't for her and was disappearing back to the library. But she stayed where she was. She said goodbye to her dad, ended the phone call, and continued to read up on herself. She was single, though she had been in a relationship with the American Olympic medal-winning diver Scott Richards for 3 years, and briefly lived with him in California, where they resided in La Jolla, San Diego. She now lived in West London. Having read the entire page, she put the phone down and decided to go find out if there was a pool. She wanted to do what she would be doing in this life, and what she would be doing was swimming. And maybe the water would help her think of what she could say. It was an exceptional swim, even if it gave her little creative inspiration. And it calmed her after the experience of having a conversation with her dead father. She had the pool to herself and glided through length after length of breaststroke without having to think about it. It felt so empowering to be that fit and strong and to have such mastery of the water that she momentarily stopped worrying about her father and having to give the speech she really wasn't prepared for. But as she swam, her mood changed. She thought of those years her dad had gained and her mother had lost. And as she thought, she became angrier and angrier at her father, which fueled her to swim even faster. She had always imagined her parents were too proud to get divorced, so instead let their resentments fester inside, projecting them onto their children, and Nora in particular. And swimming had been her only ticket to approval. Here, in this life she was in now, she had pursued a career to keep him happy, while sacrificing her own relationships, her own love of music, her own dreams beyond anything that didn't involve a medal, her own life. And her father had paid this back by having an affair with this Nadia person and leaving her mother, and he still got terse with her. After all that, screw him. Or at least this version of him. As she switched to freestyle, she realized it wasn't her fault her parents had never been able to love her the way parents were meant to, without condition. It wasn't her fault her mother focused on her every flaw, starting with the asymmetry of her ears. No. It went back even earlier than that. The first problem had been that Nora had dared, somehow, to arrive into existence at a time when her parents' marriage was relatively fragile. Her mother fell into depression, and her father turned to tumblers of single malt. She did 30 more lengths, and her mind calmed, and she started to feel free. Just her and the water. But when she eventually got out of the pool and went back to her room, she dressed in the only clean clothes in her hotel room, smart navy trouser suit, and stared at the inside of her suitcase. She felt the profound loneliness emanating from it. There was a copy of her own book. She was staring out from the cover with steely-eyed determination and wearing a Team GB swimsuit. She picked it up and saw, in small print, that it was co-written with Amanda Sands. Amanda Sands, the internet told her, was ghostwriter to a whole host of sporting celebrities. Then she looked at her watch. It was time to head to the lobby. Standing waiting for her were two smartly dressed people she didn't recognize, and one she most definitely did. He was wearing a suit and was clean-shaven in this life, his hair side-parted and businesslike. But he was the same Joe, his dark eyebrows as bushy as ever. "That's the Italian in you," as their mother used to say. "Joe?" What's more, he was smiling at her. A big, brotherly, uncomplicated smile. "Morning, sis," he said, surprised by and a little awkward from the length of the hug she was giving him. When the hug was over, he introduced the other two people he was standing with. "This is Priya from Gulliver Research, the people organizing the conference, obviously. And this is Rory, obviously, from Celebrity Speakers." "Hi, Priya," said Nora. "Hi, Rory. So nice to meet you." "Yes, it is," said Priya, smiling. "We're so pleased to have you."
"You say that like we've never met before," said Rory with a booming laugh.
Nora backtracked. "Yes, I know we've met, Rory. Just my little joke. You know my sense of humour."
"You have a sense of humour?"
"Good one, Rory."
"Okay," her brother said, looking at her and smiling. "Do you want to see the space?"
She couldn't stop smiling. Here was her brother. Her brother, whom she hadn't seen in 2 years and hadn't had any semblance of a good relationship with in far longer, looking healthy and happy, and like he actually liked her.
"The space?" "Yeah, the hall where you're doing the talk."
"It's all set up," Priya added helpfully.
"Bloody big room," said Rory approvingly, as he cradled a paper cup of coffee.
So Nora agreed, and was led into a vast blue conference room with a wide stage and around 1,000 empty chairs. A technician in black came up and asked her, "What do you fancy, lapel or headset or handheld?"
"Sorry? What kind of mic will you want up there?"
"Oh."
"Headset," her brother interjected on Nora's behalf.
"Yeah, headset," said Nora.
"I was just thinking," her brother said, "after that nightmare we had with the microphone in Cardiff."
"Yeah, totally. What a nightmare."
Priya was smiling at her, wanting to ask something.
"Am I right in thinking you've got no multimedia stuff? No slides or anything?"
Her brother and Rory were looking at her, a little concerned. This was clearly a question she should know the answer to and didn't.
"Yes," she said, then saw her brother's expression.
"I don't. Yes, I don't. I don't have any multimedia stuff." And they all looked at her like she was not quite right, but she smiled through it.
Peppermint tea. 10 minutes later, she was sitting on her own with her brother in something called the VIP Business Lounge, which was just a small airless room with some chairs and a table offering a selection of today's newspapers. A couple of middle-aged men in suits were typing things into laptops. By this point, she had worked out that her brother was her manager, and that he'd been her manager for 7 years since she'd given up professional swimming.
"Are you okay about all this?" her brother asked, having just got two drinks from the coffee machine.
He tore a sachet to release a tea bag, peppermint. He placed it into the cup of hot water he'd taken from the coffee machine. Then he handed it to Nora. She had never drunk peppermint tea in her life.
"That's for me." "Yeah, well, it was the only herbal they had."
He had a coffee for himself that Nora secretly craved. Maybe in this life she didn't drink caffeine.
"Are you okay about all this?"
"Okay about all what?" Nora wondered.
"The talk, today. Oh, yeah. How long is it again?
40 minutes.
Sure.
It's a lot of money. I upped it from 10.
That's very good of you.
Well, I still get my 20%. Hardly a sacrifice.
Nora tried to think how she could unlock their shared history. How she could find out why, in this life, they were sitting together and getting along. It might have been money, but her brother had never been particularly money-motivated. And yeah, sure, he'd obviously been upset when Nora walked away from the deal with a record company. But that had been because he wanted to play guitar in the Labyrinth for the rest of his life and be a rock star. After dipping it a few times, Nora let the tea bag free in the water.
Do you ever think of how our lives could have been different? You know, like if I had never stuck with swimming.
Not really.
I mean, what do you think you'd be doing if you weren't my manager?
I manage other people too, you know.
Yeah, well, of course, I know that.
Obviously. I suppose I probably wouldn't be managing anyone without you. I mean, you were the first. And you introduced me to Kai and then Natalie. And then Eli, so... She nodded, as if she had any idea who Kai and Natalie and Eli were.
True, but maybe you'd have found some other way.
Who knows? Or maybe I'd still be in Manchester, I don't know.
Manchester?
Yeah. You remember how much I loved it up there, at uni.
It was really hard not to look surprised at any of this. At the fact that this brother she was getting on with and working with was also someone who went to university. In her root life, her brother did A-levels and applied to go to Manchester to do history, but he never got the grades he needed. Probably because he was too busy getting stoned with Ravi every night. And then decided he didn't want to go to uni at all. They chatted a bit more. At one point he became distracted by his phone. Nora noticed his screensaver was of a radiant, handsome, smiling man she had never seen before. She noticed her brother's wedding ring and feigned a neutral expression.
So, how's married life?
Joe smiled. It was a genuinely happy smile. She hadn't seen him smile like that for years. In her root life, Joe had always been unlucky in love. Although she had known her brother was gay since he was a teenager, he hadn't officially come out until he was 22. And he'd never had a happy or long-term relationship. She felt guilt that her life had the power to shape her brother's life in such meaningful ways.
Oh, you know, Ewan. Ewan's Ewan.
Nora smiled back as if she knew who Ewan was and exactly what he was like.
Yeah, he's great. I'm so happy for you both.
He laughed. We've been married 5 years now. You're talking as if me and him have just got together.
No, I'm just, you know, I sometimes think that you're lucky.
So in love and happy.
He wants a dog, he smiled. That's our current debate. I mean, I wouldn't mind a dog, but I'd want a rescue. And I wouldn't want a bloody Maltipoo or a Bichon. I'd want a wolf. You know, a proper dog.
Nora thought of Voltaire. Animals are good company.
Yeah. You still want a dog?
I do.
Or a cat? Cats are too disobedient, he said, sounding like the brother she remembered. Dogs know their place.
Disobedience is the true foundation of liberty. The obedient must be slaves. He looked perplexed.
Where did that come from? Is that a quote?
Yeah.
Henry David Thoreau. You know, my fave philosopher. Since when were you into philosophy?
Of course. In this life, she'd never have done a philosophy degree. While her root self had been reading the works of Thoreau and Lao Tzu and Sartre in a stinky student flat in Bristol, her current self had been standing on Olympic podiums in Beijing. Weirdly,
She felt just as sad for the version of her who had never fallen in love with the simple beauty of Thoreau's Walden, or the stoical meditations of Marcus Aurelius, as she had felt sympathy for the version of her who never fulfilled her Olympic potential.
Oh, I don't know. I just came across some of his stuff on the internet.
Ah, cool. We'll check him out. You could drop some of that into your speech.
Nora felt herself go pale.
I'm thinking of maybe doing something a little different today. I might, improvise a little.
Improvising was, after all, a skill she'd been practicing.
I saw this great documentary about Greenland the other night. Made me remember when you were obsessed with the Arctic and you cut out all those pictures of polar bears and stuff.
Yeah. Mrs. Elm said the best way to be an Arctic explorer was to be a glaciologist. So that's what I wanted to be.
Mrs. Elm, he whispered. That rings a bell.
School librarian.
That was it. You used to live in that library, didn't you?
Pretty much.
Just think, if you hadn't stuck with swimming, you'd be in Greenland right now.
Svalbard, she said.
Sorry?
It's a Norwegian archipelago, way up in the Arctic Ocean.
Okay, Norway then, you'd be there.
Maybe. Or maybe I'd still be in Bedford, moping around, unemployed, struggling to pay the rent.
Don't be daft. You'd have always done something big.
She smiled at her brother's innocence.
In some lives, me and you might not even get on.
Nonsense.
I hope so.
Joe seemed a bit uncomfortable and clearly wanted to change the topic.
Hey, guess who I saw the other day?
Nora shrugged, hoping it was going to be someone she'd heard of.
Ravi. Do you remember Ravi?
She thought of Ravi, telling her off in the newsagents only yesterday.
Oh yeah, Ravi.
Well, I bumped into him.
In Bedford?
Ha! God no. Haven't been there for years. No, it was at Blackfriars Station. Totally random, like I haven't seen him in over a decade, at least.
He wanted to go to the pub. So I explained I was teetotal now, and then I got into having to explain I'd been an alcoholic and all of that. That I hadn't had a glass of wine or a puff on a joint in years.
Nora nodded as if this wasn't a bombshell, since I got into a mess after Mum died.
I think he was like, who is this guy?
But he was fine, he was cool. He's working as a cameraman now, still doing some music on the side. Not rock stuff, DJing apparently. Remember that band me and him had years ago, The Labyrinths?
It was becoming easier to fake vagueness.
Oh yeah, The Labyrinths, of course. That's a blast from the past.
Yeah, got the sense he pines for those days, even though we were crap and I couldn't sing.
What about you? Do you ever think about what could have been if The Labyrinths had made it big?
He laughed a little sadly.
I don't know if anything could have been.
Maybe you needed an extra person.
I used to play those keyboards Mum and Dad got you.
Did you?
When did you have time for that?
A life without music. A life without reading the book she had loved. But also, a life where she got on with her brother. A life where she hadn't had to let him down.
Anyway, Ravi wanted to say hi. And wanted to catch up. He only works one tube stop away, so he's going to try and come to the talk.
What? Oh, that's... I wish he wouldn't.
Why?
I just never really liked him.
Joe frowned.
Really?
I can't remember you saying that.
He's okay. A good guy. Bit of a waster, maybe, back in the day. But he seems to have got his act together a bit.
Nora was unsettled.
Joe?
Yeah?
You know when Mum died?
Yeah.
Where was I?
What do you mean?
Are you okay today, sis?
Are the new tablets working?
Tablets? She checked in her bag and started to rummage. saw a small box of antidepressants in her bag. Her heart sank.
I just wanted to know. Did I see much of Mum before she died?
Joe frowned. He was still the same Joe, still unable to read his sister, still wanting to escape reality. You know we weren't there. It happened so fast. She didn't tell us how ill she was, to protect us, or maybe because she didn't want us to tell her to stop drinking.
Drinking? Mum was drinking.
Joe's worry increased.
Sis, have you got amnesia?
She was on a bottle of gin every day since Nadia came onto the scene.
Yeah, of course, I remember.
Plus, you had the European Championships coming up and she didn't want to interfere with that.
Jesus, I should have been there.
One of us should have been there, Joe. We both... His expression frosted suddenly. You were never that close to Mum, were you?
Why this sudden... I got closer to her.
I mean, I would have.
You're freaking me out.
You're acting not quite yourself.
Nora nodded.
Yes, I just... Yes, I think you're right. I think it's just the tablets.
She remembered her mother, in her final month, saying, I don't know what I would have done without you.
She'd probably said it to Joe, too. But in this life, she'd had neither of them.
Then Priya arrived into the room, grinning, clutching her phone and some kind of a clipboard.
It's time, she said.
The tree that is our life.
5 minutes later, Nora was back in the hotel's vast conference room. At least 1,000 people were watching the first speaker conclude her presentation. The author of Zero to Hero, the book Dan had beside his bed in another life. But Nora wasn't really listening, as she sat in her reserved seat in the front row. She was too upset about her mother, too nervous about the speech. So she just picked up the odd word or phrase that floated into her mind like croutons in minestrone. Little known fact. Ambition. What you might be surprised to hear is that, if I can do it, hard knocks. It was hard to breathe in this room. It smelled of musky perfume and new carpet. She tried to stay calm. Leaning into her brother, she whispered, I don't think I can do this.
What?
I think I'm having a panic attack. He looked at her, smiling, but with a toughness in his eyes that she remembered from a different life. When she'd had a panic attack before one of their early gigs with the Labyrinths at a pub in Bedford. You'll be fine.
I don't know if I can do this.
I've gone blank.
You're overthinking it.
I have anxiety. I have no other type of thinking available.
Come on, don't let us down.
Don't let us down.
But she tried to think of music. Thinking of music had always calmed her down.
A tune came to her. She was slightly embarrassed, even within herself, to realize the song in her head was Beautiful Sky. A happy, hopeful song that she hadn't sung in a long time. The sky grows dark, the black over blue, yet the stars still dare to shine for... But then the person Nora was sitting next to, a smartly dressed businesswoman in her 50s, and the source of the musky perfume smell, leaned in and whispered,
I'm so sorry about what happened to you. You know, the stuff in Portugal.
What stuff? The woman's reply was drowned out as the audience erupted into applause at that moment.
What?
She asked again. But it was too late. Nora was being beckoned towards the stage and her brother was elbowing her. Her brother's voice, bellowing almost. They want you. Off you go. She headed tentatively towards the lectern on the stage,
towards her own huge face smiling out triumphantly, golden medal around her neck, projected on the screen behind her. She had always hated being watched. "Hello," she said nervously into the microphone. "It is very nice to be here today." A 1,000 or so faces stared, waiting. She had never spoken to so many people simultaneously. Even when she had been in the Labyrinth, they had never played a gig for more than 100 people. And back then she kept the talking between the songs as minimal as possible. Working at String Theory, although she was perfectly okay talking with customers, she rarely spoke up in staff meetings, even though there had never been more than 5 people in the room. Back at university, while Izzy always breezed through presentations, Nora would worry about them for weeks in advance. Joe and Rory were staring at her with baffled expressions. The Nora she had seen in the TED talk was not this Nora, and she doubted she could ever become that person, not without having done all that she had done. "Hello. My name is Nora Seed." She hadn't meant it to be funny, but the whole room laughed at this. There had clearly been no need to introduce herself. "Life is strange," she said. "How we live it all at once, in a straight line. But really, that's not the whole picture.